Thank you for joining us here so early this morning. This is going to be a little bit different in format from some of the other sessions that you may have attended here this week, so let me just clue you in on what exactly is going to be taking place. This is starting at exactly 6 minutes past the hour. This will be a one-hour live broadcast of the Brian Lehrer Show, which is my program back on WNYC, New York Public Radio. That's New York City's NPR station. Some of you may have been here yesterday for the panel that we did in another live broadcast, but this will be live radio in addition to this session out here at the Aspen Institute. And so as such, that's going to mean a couple of different things. For one thing, you'll be seeing me wearing these headphones the entire hour, and that's because I'll be taking secret instructions from my producers and engineers over there. It also means that we will be taking a couple of 60-second breaks during the hour. So during that time, you'll have a few seconds to talk with each other. But I'll have to get you quiet again very quickly to get back to radio sound. Now, we're normally a call-in show in New York, and today you are the callers. So I'm sure you're going to hear a lot of interesting and provocative ideas from our panelists, and we will want to hear your reactions, your ideas, because this is angled somewhat around advice for the next president, whoever he may be. We can hear some of that from you, too. You'll notice there are index cards on the tables. And so if you have a question for one of the panelists, write it down on the card and then hold it up in the air when you're ready to signal one of the two producers with wireless mics who will be walking through the audience. And, of course, we won't be able to get to all your questions, but we'll try to fit in a few, and we want to make sure that the questions are relevant. So we'll take a look at the index cards. At the time that you are asked to speak, if you are, please be brief and to the point. Your best 30-second question or thought, and if we go to you to ask your question, to read your question, the producer will hold the microphone for you, and if you need any additional reminder to keep it brief, you may see a red card, just like in the presidential debates, which would mean very gently wrap it up. Okay, now I want to ask all of you to turn off cell phones, Blackberries, any other electronic devices, not just on to vibrate, but off, because otherwise we can still get interference into the microphones. And we will wrap this up precisely at 8:59, which is 10:59 Eastern time at the end of the radio hour. So we are very much to clock with live broadcast time. I also want to invite you to join WNYC's other live event here, which will be you see the cards on your table, Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson live at Aspen here in the McNulty Room, and that will be a live taping of their Arts and Culture and Issues show, including a live performance by Steve Earle, along with Sarah Jones playing characters from her show Bridge and Tunnel and Howard Gardner on The Creative Mind, so that should be really good here tomorrow night. And thanks very much to the Aspen Ideas Festival and their great team, including Walter Isaacson, Kitty Boone, Jim Spiegelman, Jamie Miller, and Jen Myers. Some of you, by the way, may have gotten an incorrect version of the lineup for this panel, which said that it would include Walter Isaacson. Walter is not in this, but I will introduce the great guests who are as we start in 15 seconds, so stand by. From the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, it's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show today. Happy 4th of July, everyone. We are live here in Aspen. People have taken their seats for a 4th of July breakfast session of the Ideas Festival that I am about to moderate. And I'm glad to hear the early morning enthusiasm from the crowd. It is only 8 a.m. Mountain Time, and if I expected bleariness, I think we're getting anything but so far. I can't see if there is red, white, and blue cream cheese for people's muffins or maybe instead of orange juice, some patriotic Samuel Adams beer. Okay, that's for lunch. Maybe the reason that you're all so awake and alert at this hour is because Aspen, as I discovered early this morning, has what might be one of the worst 4th of July traditions in America, which is the 6 a.m. canyon boom. How many of you heard the 6 a.m. canyon boom? How many of you did not know what the 6 a.m. canyon boom was when you heard of it? Almost all the hands have gone up in the room. And I have to say that having spent part of last evening chatting with Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, my thoughts immediately ran to the worst kind of patriotic fears. But it's just a 4th of July tradition, the same kind of boom that I understand the miners use to set off landslides when they are appropriate for the environment here. But this session is called Teddy, John, and Barack, Advice for the Next President. The Teddy in question is Teddy Roosevelt, whose name just keeps coming up in this election year, a century after his heyday. Why? Well, he believed in a muscular foreign policy, and he helped convince America to undertake a history-changing war of choice. He was a maverick Republican, a progressive reformer for labor and the environment against the excesses of the so-called robber barons of that era, and more. And, of course, any analogy with the past is going to fall into meaningless symbolism after a while, usually after a short while, and it certainly does with TR after a point. So we will use Teddy Roosevelt, let's say, as a jumping-off point to talk with four great panelists about this moment in history as Barack Obama and John McCain battle for the presidency of the United States. Let me ask you to hold your applause until I've introduced everybody and told you a little bit about who they are. With us for this are Joshua Hawley, a law clerk to Chief Justice Roberts and author of a brand new book called Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. Also, Stanford University historian David Kennedy, a history mentor to Josh Hawley, who wrote the preface to the book, as well as many books of his own, including The American Pageant, A History of the Republic, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. And back in the 70s, he edited a book on progressivism, so maybe some of that will come up today. John Podesta is here, White House Chief of Staff to President Bill Clinton, and now President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, a think tank calling for a new progressivism. And Congresswoman Jane Harman, Democrat from California, a leading voice and sometimes an independent voice from some other leaders in her party on foreign affairs and intelligence and homeland security. So please thank all our guests for joining us. And thank you all from me for doing this live broadcast on WNYC from the Aspen Ideas Festival. So, Josh Hawley, you're the new kid on the block for most people here. So let's let everyone get to know you a little bit. You're 26 years old?
28 now, actually.
28. I read an old bio. You're a grad of Yale Law School and a clerk to Chief Justice Roberts. Why'd you write a book about Theodore Roosevelt and not something about the law?
Well, I became interested in Theodore Roosevelt as a freshman at Stanford University, and I was fascinated by the change that Roosevelt's presidency brought about in American government and in the American presidency. So that's sort of what led me to him in the first place. And then as I really dug in to Roosevelt and began to read his speeches and follow his career, I became more and more impressed and taken by his ideas, even more than the institutional changes that he achieved or that he spurred. But the ideas that he used to justify both his policies and his changes really struck me as interesting and as somewhat uncommon. He didn't sound like a 20th century or 21st century politician. And so that grabbed my attention and held it for a number of years and resulted in this book.
Since we're at the Ideas Festival, ideas such as what?
Roosevelt tended to see freedom as not just a set of specific conditions, but as a whole way of life. So he tended to think of democracy as an ongoing project that involved the entire community. And he also thought that democracy depended on a particular social context. You had to have certain social institutions to make democracy work, and you needed to have a certain kind of citizen. Not just any type of citizen could sustain a democracy over the long run. So this made him sound a lot like the founding fathers in many respects, like a Republican with a lowercase r. This is a way of talking and thinking that was very commonplace in the 18th century and the 19th century, but becomes less and less common in the 20th century, and we don't hear many echoes of this language any longer. So Roosevelt's policies were really aimed at sustaining those social institutions that he thought made democracy possible.
Does that relate to the subtitle of your book, which I found very interesting, Preacher of Righteousness? It makes T.R. sound like, I don't know, Jerry Falwell or Martin Luther King, rather than the concrete things like war and trust-busting that we tend to know him for. Why preacher of righteousness?
His concept of righteousness was really an extremely broad one. He thought of righteousness as synonymous with manliness, as synonymous with democratic civic virtue. He thought that, again, going back to this idea that only a certain kind of citizen could sustain a democracy, he thought that citizens had to possess certain character traits and qualities, and he summarized all of those things with this word of righteousness. And the phrase is actually one that was used by his friend Gifford Pinchot, who upon his death said that Roosevelt was the greatest preacher of righteousness of his generation. He called Americans to high living, to noble living, and made it seem like the natural thing. When I saw that, I loved that phrase and thought that it captured Roosevelt's politics perfectly.
Again, freedom as a way of life?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
And while you seem to admire many things about Teddy Roosevelt, you also seem to judge him quite harshly for being a civic perfectionist to the point of it leading him to Hitlerian ideas of eugenics, and you compare him with Nietzsche. Hitler, Nietzsche, and T.R.?
Well, one of the dark aspects of Roosevelt's politics and of his political ideas was this distinct racialist element. Roosevelt, like many thinkers of his era, believed in the viability of the concept of race, and he believed that much of world history could be explained as a competition between different races. And so he tended to think that the American race, and he did think there was such a thing as an American race, was part of this broader thing called the English-speaking or Teutonic race. And he tended to see many of his policies as attempting to promote that, to promote these racial virtues, to make the race strong. This led him, I think, into all kinds of dangerous ideas, and to the extent that he wanted to use the national government to actually promote the well-being of the race and, in fact, attempt to promote racial purity and racial virtue. That, I think, is very dangerous indeed and is a very, again, dark negative aspect of his politics and his legacy.
And one more thing before we bring in our other guests. In the epilogue, you argue more that Roosevelt's time was not like our own than that it is. For example, you say his refusal to mistake the conditions of liberty for the thing itself made him a national icon and makes him and his era so different from our own, your words. Can you go into that a little bit?
I think one of the most interesting things about the progressive era is that the host of reformers who comprised or composed that era, everybody from the social gospel reformers to municipal good government reformers in the city to farmers and so forth in the West and South, they all tended to think of the challenges, the Industrial Revolution and the challenges facing the country as first and foremost, or maybe I should say as ultimately, threats to democracy, to the American way of life. So they thought of the industrial era as presenting challenges to their prosperity and to their quality of life, but ultimately, more importantly, as challenges to the democratic way of life that made that prosperity possible. I think maybe we tend not to think of the challenges confronting us in quite the same way. I think we tend to skip the bit about these challenges, how they're affecting our democratic way of life, the institutions that sustain our democracy. We tend to go, I think, straight to the quality of life / prosperity aspects. We internalize or receive the challenges, think about them as, you know, how is this going to affect our quality of life? How is this going to affect our material prosperity? They were concerned about those things too, but only insofar as those things resulted from the social institutions that made democracy possible. These people were just absolutely focused and completely zeroed in on the notion of self-government and preserving the institutions of self-government. That's a very different way, I think, of thinking about economic and global challenges than we tend to have.
So when you hear all these campaign and media-driven parallels between Teddy Roosevelt's time and our own, do you just scoff at all that?
Well, I think that there, I think in many senses, this is a TR moment in the sense that the country really seems to be ready for a challenge to new collective endeavors. And also, I think there is an increasing interest in the country, maybe particularly among a younger demographic, a sort of a 35 and younger demographic, about the health of our democracy. And do we really have a well-functioning democracy? Are our democratic institutions working well? That's a very progressive sort of TR way of looking at things. I think that's beginning to bubble to the surface and is becoming more and more common. So there are some distinct parallels there, but I think our political leaders and even our presidential candidates still tend not to speak in TR's language. There are more dissimilarities than similarities at this point.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Aspen Ideas Festival. If you're just joining us, we've been hearing so far from Joshua Hawley, a clerk to Chief Justice John Roberts and author of a brand new book about Theodore Roosevelt called Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. Let me bring in next historian David Kennedy from Stanford University, kind of a history mentor to Josh Hawley and who wrote the preface to the book. Professor Kennedy, can I get you to muse a little bit on the idea of the relevance of Teddy Roosevelt and his ideas and that era? People are calling for a new progressivism, as we'll hear from John Podesta in a couple of minutes. The relevance of that era to our current moment?
Well, you made me think when you asked Josh Hawley just a moment ago about the contrasts or the differences between Roosevelt's time and our own. One of the most striking contrasts is the fact that 100 years ago, in Theodore Roosevelt's era, the political party that was the principal vehicle for progressive reform was the Republican Party. That seems a pretty dramatic contrast with the party situation today. But I think Josh said something that I think does suggest to us the relevance of Theodore Roosevelt for our own time, and it has to do with Roosevelt's sense that the institutional structure of this society needed to be seriously overhauled in his day if the society were to preserve its democratic values and practices. And there's all kinds of things in the historical record about the institutional changes he tried to and often did succeed in effecting. The Meat Inspection Act, the Hepburn Act for regulation of the railroads, the strengthening of the Forest Service under Gifford Pinchot, and so on. Institutions that have come right down to the present day in many ways, slightly modified form perhaps. But among Roosevelt's great disappointments, I think, was his inability to take this country fully into the international arena and have it play a role internationally to commensurate with its power and responsibilities. His successor, Woodrow Wilson, moved far in that direction, but the person who really, in a sense, realizes Theodore Roosevelt's dream in the international arena of making this country a principal player and indeed a leader in the international system was Franklin Roosevelt. And the moment, his distant cousin. And this is focused on what Joshua Hawley just mentioned about the institutional reforms that Franklin Roosevelt brought to the international arena at the end of World War II. Winston Churchill said in August of 1945, just after the Japanese declaration of their intention to surrender, he said, "The United States stand at this moment at the summit of the world." The United States had power unparalleled, I would say, relative to the international system as a whole, even greater power than it has right now or had in the 1990s. And what did the United States do with that power in 1945? It proceeded to create a framework of multilateral institutions like the United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and a few years later, things like NATO, the Marshall Plan, the International Atomic Energy Agency. It created the latticework on which, for half a century and more, the international system enjoyed a measure of stability and peace, and on which the global economy grew to such an extent that by the end of the 20th century, a new word had been coined to describe it. The word is globalization. I believe Theodore Roosevelt would have been very proud of those institutions, and I think he'd be very dismayed today to see in what state of disrepair they are. And I do think that one of the tasks facing our next generation of political leadership, the next president, is to pay serious attention to that framework of multilateral institutions, which has been the foundation on which international peace and prosperity has been built for the last half century and more.
So, Josh Hawley, let me go back to you and see if you agree with any of that. I did notice the shot that he took at the Republican Party at the beginning of those remarks. I don't know if, as a clerk for Chief Justice Roberts, you have some partisan leanings in the other direction, or that you want to disclose that. But with his take on TR not seeing the importance of international institutions in his day, despite the great power in the world that he helped bring the United States to with his advocacy of the Spanish-American War in 1898. You want to react to your mentor here, disagree or agree with anything?
One of TR's great regrets, I think, as president and then later as the president out of office, was that he did not enjoy the sort of seminal crisis that would have allowed him really to push the United States into a permanent global role that David Kennedy was just talking about. And in fact, one of the things that really infuriated him about Woodrow Wilson is that he felt Wilson was rewarded by fate with a world war that had been denied him, and that he could have done much better. You know, he really thought Wilson just bungled the whole affair, and that if he had been president, you know, things would have come out differently, which may be true. I think that one of the things that marked Theodore Roosevelt and his approach to international affairs was his creativity. And I would just build on what David said by saying that I think in the present age, the next president needs to be able to creatively approach our international obligations and think about how we might renovate some of these multilateral international institutions from the United Nations to NATO to address a new generation of challenges. In many ways, I think the institutions that were put in place by Franklin Roosevelt at the end of the Second World War are showing their age. I mean, they need to be renovated, they need to be refashioned, updated. Theodore Roosevelt was wonderfully creative, both on the internationally but also on the domestic scene, as was Franklin Roosevelt. And we need, I think, a president with similar creativity and similar commitment to keeping America engaged internationally, but again also pushing forward and renovating those institutions that make our international engagement possible.
We'll continue in a minute. We'll bring Congresswoman Jane Harman and John Podesta, former White House Chief of Staff, into this. John Podesta calling for a new progressivism, which will get more to TR's domestic agenda and how it might relate to today. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer from the Aspen Ideas Festival on WNYC. Great start. Thank you all. So, audience, you could be writing some questions right now. When you have something written, you can raise your hand at any time. That's right, isn't it? And yes, and our screeners will come around and collect your cards and take or chat with you about what you may want to ask the panel as we go along here. And we've got about 30 seconds before we resume.
Club California event where Haynes Johnson is the speaker.
Yeah.
So the first question submitted was, will you marry me?
It's like on the scoreboard at the ballpark.
Dear Haynes, will you
All right, 10 seconds, everyone. If we could have quiet in the hall, thanks a lot. From the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, it's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show. We are here at the McNulty Room of the Aspen Institute, talking with four guests in our panel called Teddy, John, and Barack, advice for the next president. The Teddy in question being Teddy Roosevelt, as we have Joshua Hawley here at the center of this panel, a law clerk to Chief Justice Roberts and author of a brand new book called Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness, and Stanford University historian David Kennedy and Congresswoman Jane Harman and John Podesta, White House Chief of Staff to President Bill Clinton and now President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, a think tank calling for a new progressivism. And John Podesta, maybe we should spend some time on the idea of the word progressive and progressivism and the link to the TR era with our own to the extent that it applies. When you call for a new progressivism, do you mean to specifically reference the progressive era as we think of it in Rooseveltian terms?
Well, I think if you combine both Roosevelts, I think that the answer to that is yes. I think that progressivism kind of blended into liberalism during FDR's time, but it has distinct roots at the time of the turn of the century and TR's time. And as I was listening to Josh and David, it struck me that what they didn't talk about was the circumstances of the country at the time that TR really embraced the progressive agenda and listening to the bit of a gig about the Republican Party, it's important to remember that Roosevelt ran against the Republican Party in 1912 as a progressive. And maybe it's important to reflect a little bit about why that was. It was the Gilded Age. It was a time of great concentrations of wealth. It was a time when workers were really kind of on their backs, that there was a tremendous abuse in the labor force, in the industrial side of the economy. We were transitioning from an agricultural to an industrial society. The trust had concentrated power. The democracy project that Josh talked about was really aimed against corporate concentration, against railroad concentration that the farmers were reacting against, and it created a momentum and a sense of reform. And, of course, I think Roosevelt was really disappointed in his hand-picked successor, decided to embrace the call that was really coming out of the Midwest Republicans, Bob La Follette and others, to change business and to change the way we do business in the country. And if you reflect back on the 1912 platform, it was incredibly progressive and quite distinct, I think, from what we see coming from John McCain, who is certainly, I think, identifies himself with that sort of independent streak, but called for a graduated income tax, an inheritance tax, women's suffrage, workers' comp, 8-hour day. I mean, it was a platform that was really aimed at the economic circumstances of the time. And I think what's happened, I think, in our current moment is that the conservative policy is, in my view, has clearly failed this country, not only internationally but nationally. The middle class is struggling. We haven't quite figured out how to create a growing middle class in the context of a globalized world. We face a tremendous energy challenge, not just with $4 a gallon gasoline, higher electricity rates, et cetera, but what are we going to do to transform our entire economy from a high carbon to a low carbon base to deal with the challenge of climate change. And then we need to rethink and rebuild a renewed set of institutions to manage, I think, global affairs, to bring more peace, more security, and more democracy around the globe. I think the one place where TR might have been out of sync with today's progressives was that sense of imperialism that really kind of characterized his approach to foreign affairs. I think that was Franklin Roosevelt, I think, really got that right. And I think as progressives, as Democrats, and as liberals, I think we can be quite proud of that tradition, as David articulated.
Are you drawing a distinction right there between Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt in foreign affairs? Because Franklin Roosevelt also had to talk the country into a major war.
Yeah, well, I think that Franklin Roosevelt was presented with the circumstances of the great challenge of fascism and Nazism, and built and took the country to war and succeeded, but he had a vision for what that post-war world would look like that was built on extending peace and security through the cooperative endeavors and through building strong institutions, again, that David ticked through, that would essentially bind the world together rather than sort of blowing it apart. And I think that what we've seen, particularly under the kind of neoconservative theory of the case, is that the projection of power would cause people to fall in line. I think that's a failed theory. And I think that I think, Brian, you noted the height of America's at the end of World War II, standing in the world, its authority in the world. I think there's no question that over the past several years, we've seen the deterioration, certainly, of the views of not just our adversaries, but amongst our allies, of America's power and the capacity to project power.
Congresswoman Harman, is this something that you also think about? I imagine that it is, foreign affairs and national security and intelligence being among your main interests and committees that you're on in Congress, this balance between America projecting its power as need be today and doing it in a constructive way?
You bet. And, Brian, just like you, at 6 a.m., I sat up in my bed and I thought, uh-oh, they're here. They're not here, and that's very good news. And it means that for a variety of reasons, steps we've taken in this country are keeping us safer. But it also means, and this is, I think, something to celebrate on July 4th, that there are now moderate voices inside the Muslim faith that are pushing back against a very extreme, radical form perversion of that faith. And I think this will play out in constructive ways, at least I hope so, on July 4th. It was TR who said, speak softly and carry a big stick. If anything does not describe the Bush foreign policy, that might be it. The big stick part, yes. But I think there are lessons there that we should heed. I agree with John Podesta that his was the precursor of a foreign policy that Roosevelt and Truman adopted and that I think not only won the Great War but structured the peace in ways, as David Kennedy said too, that we should modernize and build on now. And I would hope that President Mick Obama is listening in here. Because there is a lot of repair work to do. I just wanted to focus on one piece of TR's record because it is very relevant to the glorious wilderness that we see outside these windows in Colorado. It was Roosevelt, TR Roosevelt, who built 150 national forests, 51 national wildlife refuges, 5 national parks, had the foresight to think of America as the safe keeper of these incredible natural resources. Yesterday, at this week of symposia, we heard Tom Friedman describe his new book, which is Hot, Flat, and Crowded, and challenge us all to come up with a new energy strategy for the world, with America projecting her leadership, which is absolutely essential to accomplish that strategy. His point being, that we're running out of time, and that in a world that is hot, the climate challenge, crowded, the population challenge, moving in a direction where we're depleting all of our natural resources and changing the whole aspect of whether or not we can survive with the climate changes, we have to move together and do something very, very different. And I would hope that the next president would pick up this mantle, build on what TR did, which was very controversial in his day. Think of America as safe keeper of this incredibly beautiful part of the globe that we inhabit, but also now show that in the next 10 years, which is about all we have to demonstrate this leadership, that we can build a world coalition. We can build on the structures put in place after World War II. To defeat this challenge, which I think will defeat us if we don't rise to the occasion.
Congresswoman, do you think that if Barack Obama is elected president, that there are going to be tensions within the Democratic Party, different streams of advice that he may be getting along the lines of what you all have been talking about with respect to America's role in the world? You are a blue dog Democrat, a member of the more centrist DLC or Democratic Leadership Council, do you think that there are going to be wings of the party tugging him in one direction and wings of the party tugging him in another direction with respect to the military, with respect to intelligence practices and things like that if Obama is the next president of the United States?
Absolutely. There are wings of the party tugging at him right now. He's being roundly criticized for the position he has taken a few weeks ago in support of compromise package on the Foreign Surveillance, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, something that I support, the compromise package. I think it's very carefully done and necessary. But there are wings in the Republican Party, too. The challenge for a leader of a party and a president of the United States is to listen and then do what that person thinks is right and have the skill sets to get the country to follow him. I think that both of our candidates will face huge challenges. Both of them offer some leadership qualities that I think are missing in the present administration. And I am a superdelegate for Obama, so I think he possesses more of the right stuff. But it will be a challenge to get the Democratic Party and to get the center behind a common set of policies.
But can I bring you out a little bit on where you come down in that, to some degree, divided Democratic Party on the FISA bill, for example? I know you were in the news for being a leader in supporting that compromise with its immunity for the telecoms and et cetera. What would be the right path? What would be the wrong path for Barack Obama as president? And what would the implications be for the state of our freedom?
Well, speak softly and carry a big stick means a lot to me. Speak softly. Use America's qualities and values to project America. I think Obama would be very good at that, and I frankly think all parts of the Democratic Party would get behind that message. Carry a big stick, you bet. That means that America is ready to use force when appropriate. One of the sad things that's happened with the mismanagement of the post-military phase in Iraq is that our military is so overstretched that I don't know whether we could project force responsibly against the bigger challenges than Iraq in the world now, which are Iran. I'm not advocating using force in Iran now. I'm actually advocating using a very effective diplomacy. But Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other places. So I think that there is an opportunity in TR-like fashion and in Franklin Roosevelt-like fashion to speak to the country, to engage in a public dialogue about what the real threats are against us and how we can win the argument against those who want to destroy us. And there's not a second to waste.
Let's go to our audience here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. We have people who want to ask questions. And let's go to the middle of the room. Let's see. Who do we have? Okay, oh, right over there. There you are. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Brian. It's Howard Gardner. We Americans like to hear upbeat news. We like an ebullient leader like TR, a bull moose. And yet the news going forward promises to be gloomy. As John Podesta says, global warming, terrorism, water shortage, economic downturn, et cetera. How should the next president, in talking to American people, balance optimism, pessimism, and realism?
Well, John, I'll take that as a question for you.
Okay. I think the one thing we need to do is kind of restore honesty between the dialogue between the president and the American public. And I think the American public can handle the truth. And I think that what that means is to be clear about the state of affairs and where we are, but also be clear about the opportunities that lie ahead with again strong progressive investments, a strategy to deal with the energy challenge that Jane mentioned, the ability to create jobs, to create a new structure for the economy, which actually restores, I think, not only job growth but wage growth for the middle class. I think you need to be real about what the big problems are in the economy, but I think you also have to offer opportunity and hope. And I think that's been the strength, really, of what's gone on during the primary seasons. I think that will be carried forward into the future. I think that Americans, if you look back at who succeeded and who hasn't, people who offer that optimistic vision, whether they're conservatives like Ronald Reagan or progressives like the men we've been talking about or my former boss, Bill Clinton, they seize the opportunity. They see where the country can go, but they have to give clarity to the narrative about how we're going to get there.
David Kennedy?
Well, I would just add that, and not to deepen the gloom, but I think we're unfortunately living in an historical moment when the credibility of the political class and political leadership is at a deep low, and not just because of the events of the last 7 years. Polling data that tries to test Americans' faith in institutions and in leadership, from the Catholic Church to the Boy Scouts to government and all the rest of it, shows marked declines from the post-World War II era to today. So I agree with you that the next president, whoever it is going to have a very difficult job making people face some pretty demanding and challenging realities. But that task is compoundedly difficult, I think, because the political class as a whole has lost some credibility.
Well, let me bring Josh Hawley in on this, because the question is about good news and bad news, and we're talking about optimism and pessimism, and I wonder if there's a generational thing here. I introduced you at the beginning of the hour as 26 years old. You corrected me that you're really 28, and I can see those lines on your face that indicate
that.
The extra 2 years. And frankly, after a week at the Aspen Ideas Festival, those lines may be getting deeper, because there is a lot of pessimism here. People are talking about a lot of serious problems. And yes, there are ideas to address those problems being articulated all over town here, but also I think we're getting a very large dose of the depth of the problems we face in global economics and global security, global environment, and other things. But does that same lack of faith in our institutions, does that same pessimism pertain to you and your peers?
Well, unfortunately, I think the answer is yes. There is, I think, a lot of, the polling data reflects this, that David was just referring to, a lot of skepticism, even cynicism among my age demographic, the 35 and under set, about our democratic institutions and our ability to handle change and reform. However, having said that, I think one of the most remarkable things about my particular demographic is you're seeing an amazing and maybe unprecedented amount of involvement. I mean, this is a group that has become extremely involved in all sorts of causes outside of government, but in all sorts of sort of reform-type movements, from the Green Movement to various social reform movements. I mean, this is a generation that I think is really interested in making a difference, really, really passionate about seeing social improvement and about working for the greater good, the common good. And so if I could just link that to TR, one of the things that made TR such a successful leader, and I think one of the reasons he's still so well thought of today, is that he said to Americans, in essence, look, our problems are serious. The challenges to our democracy are potentially quite grave. However, if we act together, we do not have to be at the mercy of impersonal economic forces. We don't have to be at the mercy of international trends. Free people can set the course of their own destiny if we act in concert and if we face together the challenges that are confronting us. I think that's a message that my generation is ready for, and one that the next president should deliver. He should challenge the country, and young people in particular, to take up the banner of reform and to take up the responsibilities of change and of democratic life, to renovate our social institutions, our international institutions, and to work together towards a new sense of the common good.
We have to take a 60-second break. We'll continue from the Aspen Ideas Festival with Joshua Hawley, David Kennedy, John Podesta, and Congresswoman Jane Harman. Stay with us.
I think the political involvement would indicate that is true. I mean, there's a big, look at the engagement of young people in the political process. Are much more progressive politically. They're willing to take on these big challenges. I think he's right about that.
Well, I hope he's right, frankly. Although a lot of that that he's talking about takes a self-consciously non-political form. It's the formal political instruments that young people are cynical.
10 seconds, folks. Here we go. Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Today, with a breakfast session out here in the Mountain Time Zone called Teddy, John, and Barack, Advice for the Next President. Our four panelists, Joshua Hawley, a law clerk to Chief Justice Roberts and author of a brand new book called Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. Stanford University historian David Kennedy, who wrote the preface to Hawley's book, as well as many books of his own. John Podesta, White House Chief of Staff to President Bill Clinton, and now President and CEO of the Center for American Progress. And Congresswoman Jane Harman, Democrat from California. And let's go back to our breakfast audience here. We have another question over here on this side. Hello.
Since Teddy Roosevelt, I'm Linda Bash, and since Teddy Roosevelt and FDR, there have been two huge social movements in the U.S., the civil rights and the women's movements. What difference will or should the aspirations and visions of people of color and women make to the advice to be given to Barack and John for domestic and globally focused policies?
Congresswoman Harman, can I direct that to you?
Sure. Well, I think a big difference 100 years after TR is a sense that certainly I have, and most people who have been active at this Ideas Festival have, of inclusion, the need to include all Americans, both genders, all races, in our policymaking going forward. And I was just saying to Josh during this little break about his answer to the last question being, you know, how gloomy and how pessimistic should we be, that I am very optimistic because I think this set of challenges, while huge, offers an opportunity for the right leader to include the whole country in a public dialogue about what the right answers are. And there are communications tools that obviously didn't exist 100 years ago. I mean, after all, there was no NPR 100 years ago. And then let's move along to the web.
We
and
paid
other
her
means
a lot of money to say that.
Of organizing people, and not just from the top down, from the bottom up. That's what you're talking about. You're talking about some huge movements in the country. Obviously, as a woman, I very much resonate with that one. I remember the dark ages some time back when I was trying to get into law school and so forth at a time when few women did that. But my point is that this time, those movements have laid the ground, and so have others, the environmental movement. In a big way, for the next leader, hopefully a visionary, courageous leader, not afraid to listen and then take actions he thinks are warranted. We almost said she thinks are warranted. But at any rate, have set up an opportunity for us to get to much better and much more widely supported policies than we've had in the past.
Let's go to our next questioner down in front here.
Bob Hormats, my question goes to the issue of international institutional change that David spoke about and described what had happened after World War II. Josh mentioned the point that Roosevelt didn't really have a crisis to enable him to do the kind of great things he wanted to do. George W. Bush did have a crisis, and one of the failures of his administration, I think, was that he did not use the crisis after 9/11 and the amount of global support the United States had to develop a greater level and degree of international cooperation. At the current environment, we have the IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, et cetera, but they're meant to deal with the post-World War II kinds of issues. Now we have a new set of issues, including those old ones, but we all have energy, the environment, proliferation, spread of infectious diseases, and we need also to bring in new countries, China, India, Brazil, and others. The trouble is, in the current environment, we're very inward-looking. Much of the campaign has been focused on inward-looking issues, very domestic-oriented, and yet virtually none of the things we want to do internationally in any of these areas will be done if we can't expand the global institutions we've got, create new ones, and create a greater level of cooperation to include these new powers. How do we go about changing that domestic environment to get people to understand this and then a new president to have the mandate to do it?
David Kennedy, you said the what before. Now he's asking you the how.
Well, I'd refer back to the star of our show, Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, one of his principal legacies to us, it seems to me, was his effort to deparochialize the American people and American politics to make Americans understand that they were citizens of the world as well as citizens of the United States, and to at least point the country in the direction of playing an engaged and responsible role in the international system. So I think that's a very valuable legacy that we should cherish. I think you're absolutely right that it was implicit what I was saying earlier, the institutional structure that the United States took the lead in creating and putting in place after World War II is badly in need of updating. We heard some discussion yesterday afternoon between Sam Nunn and Colin Powell about the issue of nuclear proliferation. We heard from Tom Friedman yesterday about energy and environmental issues. I might add to that international migration. We think we have an immigration issue in this country. We have approximately 36 million foreign-born people in the United States. There are 200 million people in the world living outside their country of origin. This is not just an American issue. So on all of these issues, energy, environment, nuclear proliferation, international migration, international capital flows, the stability of the exchange rates, all of these issues, we need to be a partner with other countries in multilateral institutions that are scaled and created to deal with these issues in the 21st century. I don't think we have that system in place today.
John, you wanted to crack at this, but...
I'll just be very brief. The interesting thing is there's no stream of isolationism in this campaign. Do you remember a presidential campaign where both candidates were essentially running around the world campaigning? But Senator McCain has just been to Canada and Colombia. Senator Obama has just announced that he's going to Jordan, to Israel, to London, to Germany. I think they both understand that we need American leadership in the world. They have very different, I think, approaches about the application of that leadership.
Josh, at the very end of your book, and by the way, just to follow up on that, I heard that Dubai was trying to get Obama and McCain to have a debate there. Do you think that's a good idea?
I think as long as it's Lincoln Douglas style.
Congresswoman, you're shaking your head.
No, I think that's rather silly, but I would just say that the role of the nation state has shrunk in this globalized, interconnected world. And why that matters is that these movements, bottom-up movements in this country that are going to change the way we do politics and make it more inclusive are all over the world as well. And you don't know in a chat room whether the person's in America or is in Dubai. So there is an opportunity for the next president of the United States to be a world leader in a way that we have never before contemplated.
Josh, at the very end of your book, you do identify two lessons that America today might learn from Teddy Roosevelt and his time, that liberty is a fundamentally social undertaking and that politics is a profoundly moral undertaking. Now, those are both big ideas, maybe even too big for the Ideas Festival. But can you talk about each of them a little bit? Liberty is a fundamentally social undertaking. Don't we keep hearing liberty invoked today as the absence of government or social intrusions, especially in economics?
Yeah, I think we tend to think and have tended to think since, I would argue, since 1912 and certainly since the middle part of the century, is liberty is fundamentally the absence of any restraint. So if you get to choose what you want to do, you're free. Roosevelt thought of this, thought of political liberty in a much richer sense. And let me just connect this back to something that John said earlier about the middle class and the worries that in the new technological age we're really seeing the vanishing of the middle. We have an educated elite who are doing quite well. We're losing a middle class. You know, Theodore Roosevelt was concerned about this as well because his thinking was that a vibrant middle class is absolutely critical to sustaining democracy. The middle class is one of the things that links the country together, high and low, that it provides a sense of common identity, but also a sense of common and shared fate. And one of the problems with having a society where you have extremes of rich and poor and no middle through which people are progressing from one end to the other is that you lose this sense of common fate, and you lose a sense of shared ideals. That makes it extremely hard to confront the common challenges that we have. I would say, in talking about liberty as a social undertaking, that is precisely the sort of challenge that we confront today. And I think when Roosevelt said that liberty is a social undertaking, he meant that certain social institutions, like the family, like the middle class, like neighborhoods, churches, etc., are vital to sustaining democracy and our democratic life and to confronting our common challenges.
And briefly, that politics is a profoundly moral undertaking. How do you mean for TR and for today?
I think TR saw that politics, that our policy choices inevitably shape the kind of people that we are. So the sort of society that we have says a lot about us as a people. And then our structure of government and our social institutions, again, tend to over time sort of change us or mold us into behaving in certain ways and into being a certain type of people. So he wanted a more generous, egalitarian, more prosperous society because he thought that, again, this sort of social equality was what would sustain democracy over time. So I think that to apply that to today, what we need to ask is we confront challenges about the future of our social welfare state, about the structure of some of our governmental institutions, is what sort of institutions are going to allow us to be, what sort of nation do we want to be, what sort of people do we want to be, and where do we want to go by reforming our social well? What sort of qualities of character do we want to promote? What sort of country do we want to have? And Roosevelt would say, when we talk about policy, that's what we ought to be asking. We ought to be asking ourselves, what kind of country do we want to have? What kind of people do we want to be? And we ought to enact policies that get us to that point.
You know, we've only got about 90 seconds left. And on that big idea, do we want to get a quick reaction from everybody going on around the room to wrap it up? Congresswoman Harmon?
Well, politics as a moral exercise, you bet. That is something we desperately need, and we need a new president who sees it that way, too, someone of character who wants a public dialogue consistent with our traditions and about a way forward and who respects the rule of law, the Constitution, and the Congress.
John Podesta?
We need to focus on the common good, and I think that the common good of the American people can project us into the future in a way that's optimistic and will restore our democracy.
David Kennedy, last word on those moral and social ideas.
Well, I'll just echo what the others have said. I think a necessary condition for the next president to be effective is somehow or other to diminish the toxic partisanship and the political paralysis that's come with it of the last decade or so.
All right. Hold your applause for just a minute for our guests, because there are a lot of people I want to thank. The Brian Lehrer Show comes to you this 4th of July all the way from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, only with a lot of work from a lot of people. We are produced today by Lisa Allison in Aspen and Kate Hines and Jody Avergon in New York. We had help from Taylor Orsi, Paige Cowett, Valerie Lipinski, and Eileen Markey, and from Chris Bannon, Julie Burstein, Lital Molad, and Nathan Lehrer. At the controls are Rob Christensen and Ed Haber in Aspen and Debbie Daughtry in New York. The executive producer of The Brian Lehrer Show is Nuala McGovern here in Aspen. Stay tuned for another hour from Aspen on WNYC New York. And now, please thank all our guests, John Podesta, Congresswoman Jane Harmon, Stanford University historian David Kennedy, and Joshua Hawley, the inspiration for this segment, the author of Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. And thanks to all of you for coming out so early in the morning here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.